Are we recording?
All right, welcome, welcome, welcome. This is season 2, episode 1 of Circular Progress. We were in a temporary broadcast location, and we have a little change to the lineup, as opposed to having our centrist Andrea this season. It's going to be myself and the conservative Paul, and hopefully we're going to get into a little bit more debate this season. So without any further ado, let's get into the big news of the day. The stimulus package is currently going through the Senate, I believe. House version passed last week, and I believe the Senate version passed already.
Did it?
I'm not sure. Actually, no. They said they were one vote short.
Let's say last I heard, it didn't have enough support to pass.
They didn't have 60 votes, so they're in conference, right? Not conference,
they'll just spend a couple more $100 billion and they'll have enough votes.
Right. Of course, with the stimulus, it's pretty difficult to get a clear answer out of anybody because there's a lot of obfuscation. Big word for the day. But what is the goal of the stimulus? Paul, I guess I'll ask you, coming from the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, what do you think that the goal of the stimulus should be? Are we looking for long-term growth, short-term growth, just a large infusion of capital, tax cuts? What do you want to see? What's your wish list for the stimulus?
Well, first of all, I think there needs to be some focus on short-term growth, but at the same time, that needs to be done so there's not a cost of long-term inflation, which is why I don't support many of the provisions that really, to me, have absolutely nothing to do with stimulus.
Such as?
And instead, I think have been added just to make the bill pass. For instance, you have the $335 million for STD prevention.
No, don't get me wrong. I'm all for STD prevention.
Right.
$1.5 million for prostitutes. Sorry, would you like to rebut?
I'll reserve judgment on that particular point until I can research that further. I'd like to see how these prostitutes are getting money, how the government knows who the prostitutes are, and other such things.
Maybe it's the only ones that have already been busted.
Yeah, maybe. Get them some new wigs, clothes. But it's interesting because this whole stimulus idea, I'm not necessarily behind it. I believe that the liberals in this country have been complicit in the unraveling of safety nets over the past 16 years. Notice I said 16 years, not 8. And other failed economic policies. I want to get your opinion real quick on particularly the House Republicans. Senate Republicans don't really have a message, and neither do the House ones, but at least they're out giving press conferences, and John Boehner, I really want to mispronounce his name, but I'll be respectful. How do you feel about the House Repubs? Are they doing a good job supporting the Republican idea, or are they just being obstructionists for the sake of being obstructionists?
Well, first of all, I think they've done more than just vote against it. I've heard some with constructive alternatives. Don't ask me what they were. I don't have anything in front of me. But I have heard that there have been some constructive alternatives that have been suggested. First of all, I think they are finally doing what they hadn't been doing for the last probably 4 years, which is actually coming back to Republican principles and not letting themselves be bought or just jumping on the bandwagon or drinking the Kool-Aid. They are standing up for the Republican values and ideals that their constituents elected them to represent. So I think they're doing the right thing. First of all, they're sticking to their principles. I'm a big fan of that.
Right.
And second, I don't think it is obstructionist. I think they're trying to send a genuine message that, you know, we're still here and we don't support what basically amounts to bunches and oodles of handouts, which may include noodles. There may be oodles and noodles of noodles in there.
Hand out to the noodle conglomerates. The
noodle, they're bailing out the noodle-making industry.
Right, right. That's interesting, because from my point of view, it just seems like the Republicans are just... I understand where they're coming from, because a commentator, I believe it was Megan McArdle, mentioned, like, for example, there's no upside for Republicans here. If they support the stimulus, then Obama gets the credit for it. If they go against it and it works, they're screwed anyway. But if they go against it and it doesn't work, they can say, hey, I didn't vote for this. So, I mean, to me, it just seems like they're being obstructionist for the sake of it, because I don't see any strong legislative alternatives. There's no, for example, like House Republican stimulus that they're saying, this is our bill, this is specifically what's in it. All they're really saying is, we'd like more tax cuts, or they point to one or two like provisions in it and say, like, here's an example of pork, so therefore this whole bill is bad. Do you wish that there was an actual alternative stimulus that they would be promoting?
Well, like I said,
legislatively,
I have not seen any of their specific legislation, and quite frankly,
I don't believe there is any.
There's no point in writing any either, because it's not going to get past the Democratic-controlled House, Senate, and presidency. One alternative, which I think would be go a lot further to solving the problem than spending more money that we don't have and printing money that we don't have, is instead of giving all this money to different organizations and everything, some job creation is needed. I support that.
Right.
But instead of doing all this other stuff, you suspend the payroll tax and personal income tax for 1 year. The government is not spending any money, and this money is going directly to the people so they can pay their mortgages and things like that. So instead of being given money that the government doesn't have, they're just keeping money that they make, and in keeping it, they're also putting money into the economy. They're able to pay down bills, which means the credit crisis can at least go down somewhat.
Right. Who would be getting these income tax credits?
Well, it's not really an income tax credit, though. It's just a complete suspension.
Suspension, yeah, sorry. For everybody, or for, like, certain brackets.
For everyone.
For everyone. Okay, so that brings me to my next point. I guess, like, the libertarian stimulus would include, like, cutting off the healthcare spending and the stimulus, cutting off all the...
Do you have an example of the healthcare spending? Because I don't know.
Not off the top of my head, but I do believe there's money in the stimulus for, like, putting health records online and just other stuff like that. It's under the title of, like, healthcare infrastructure. And then, like, traditional infrastructure, roads, water, et cetera, environmental measures. So you just want all of that out, and you just want quick bang for your buck, get the money out there, let people use the capital how they wish, basically.
Well, I do support that, and I'm not completely closed off to all infrastructure work.
Okay.
But at the same time, was it $200 million to rehabilitate the mall in Washington? I think $20 million or something for a pool in Atlanta that will hire 37 people.
Are those not jobs?
You have a calculator on that computer. Divide $20 million by 37.
I mean, I don't propose to know all the ins and outs of building a pool, but at the end of the day...
Furthermore, how big is the pool going to be, and how long are these jobs going to be there?
Right, but you got to, like, you're making a pool, so you need to hire people to clean the pool. You need people to, you need to buy from the company that makes chemicals. You know what I mean? Like, you can say that it's $20 million for a pool, but so many industries... The concrete people that have to come lay down the concrete.
Are these
well, someone has to be hired, which is the point. Someone's being employed.
Jobs after the pool is built, or is it just jobs to build the pool?
One would imagine that they would keep going, because...
Will the pool charge an entrance fee? Or will this be funded out of taxpayer dollars?
I don't know. I am not the author of this particular amendment to the bill, or earmark, if you want to call it that. But my point is that regardless of how ridiculous they might sound on their face, they are, in fact, creating jobs, and the multiplier effect of the everyone that gets employed building that pool, which you may seem wasteful, you may find wasteful, goes out shopping and spends their money in America, which therefore would...
Is there any guarantee that they have to spend the money in America on American products?
Not necessarily, but that's the most likely option, because not many people... unless you shop at Walmart... it's assumed that...
Evil corporation.
It assumes that people will at least have the opportunity to spend money on American products in America, unless they're doing a construction job and then traveling to China to buy all their goods. But I think that if the point of this is to create...
For the record, the 37 jobs I was talking about from $20 million, that's $540,000. Wait, $540,540.54 per job. How is that an effective, what's the word? Use of taxpayer dollars. Wait, they're not taxpayer dollars. We don't have those taxpayer dollars.
As I said, I'm not the author of the stimulus, and I'm not necessarily defending.
So in other words, you know it's a waste of money.
No, not necessarily. I don't know. I don't know enough information. I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt, because it's very easy to make these jobs sound stupid by saying, oh, it's for a pool or it's for the National Mall. But you have to hire people to lay the sod down in the National Mall. You have to hire landscaping companies. People are getting jobs through this, no matter how stupid you think the idea sounds on its face. People are getting employed and getting paid, so therefore it's going to have a stimulative effect, which is the purpose of it. It is simply what I'm arguing. Let's move on.
Do we have to?
I guess this leads into the next one. It seems that the stimulus. Let me just say, as a little caveat, I hate the people that say all economists believe that there should be a stimulus. Can we not acknowledge that economists are not monolithic? And in fact, the Cato Institute had a list of like 200 economists, a few of them being Nobel Prize winners, arguing the fact that we need a stimulus. So can we just say that it's not universally believed that we need a stimulus, but since that we're going to have one, the argument comes between efficiency and equity. And they were talking about this on Open Left, a big leftist blog. And I guess efficiency is what you would be arguing for. You want the greatest economic multiplier per dollar, and you don't want people building pools or whatever. You want whatever's going to be the most stimulative right now.
Well,
correct.
Well, I would argue that the best thing for our economy is the thing that creates the most permanent jobs at the lowest possible cost to the American taxpayer.
And what do you believe does that? Tax cuts, jobs, capital gains, tax cuts, like?
I don't know about capital gains, but I'm a proponent of not permanently abolishing or even suspending totally corporate taxes. But I think that if we can free up more capital for these corporations and not just corporations, small businesses, so they have more working capital, they'll then be able to employ more people, which will in turn give more money into the economy. And since we're not spending money to create these jobs, this is already money the companies are making. This will not only, first of all, it'll make more jobs, inject more money into the economy, keep more people from losing their homes. But once we're out of this recession and all these people have jobs, there will be even more people to pay taxes to pay down our national debt, which is also, $20 trillion.
We're going to cut their 5% taxes, right?
To our national debt with this one stimulus package. And how many more are we going to pass if this one doesn't work?
Okay. You lost me a little bit on the whole tax cut angle, just because I would argue that tax cuts are not a very efficient economic multiplier.
Neither spending $20 million on a pool.
Well, several institutions, I guess, have done studies and estimates of, like, the effects. For example, if you extend unemployment benefits, increase availability of food stamps, extend aid to state and local governments, you get a multiplier of, I guess, $1.50 to $1.75 for every dollar spent in economic activity.
Could you name these institutions and on what side of the political spectrum they lie?
Well, they are economic institutions. I assume that they fall on the more liberal end. But their analysis, I can get back to you or put it up on the blog post, specifically who they are. But it's the argument is that tax cuts are a fairly inefficient multiplier because the people that pay the most taxes, the wealthiest, when they get tax cuts, they don't necessarily spend it. It's the lower income people that spend the money. And conservatives have been railing.
Well, remember, I'm not talking about tax cuts for just the wealthy. I'm actually talking about
for
tax suspension
right.
for everyone.
Right. But the, for example, giving people, if you give people just capital, they might pay down their debts, which is what a lot of people did with the stimulus. They got their checks, and all of it went to debt. They didn't buy anything. And our crisis isn't necessarily that there is a lack of capital, because we've seen what happened. We saw what happened when the bailout happened, the bank bailout. They took the capital, and a lot of them didn't start lending again. So obviously capital wasn't their problem. A lot of the problem is that no one is producing anymore. So the argument for making pools infrastructure is that that gets people producing again, making actual products. So it's good in that people have jobs, and we have the nice little side effect of having tangible goods left over, or having made improvements to our infrastructure and our efficiency, which is as good as capital, if not better.
My turn to ask a question.
Okay.
Are you supportive of the what would essentially be a New Deal 2.0?
That's I fall short of saying that, because I don't think the New Deal was solely what got us out of the Great Depression. I mean, World War II was a big part of it. You know, for like at least 4% of our adult male population like died. Like a large population of people died. You know what I mean? And we spent up to, at points, we spent up to 50% of, like, our GDP. So, I mean, I don't think that's it's necessarily a repeatable model. But I'm in
especially
favor.
Especially since this time it'll involve nukes.
Right. I think that the stimulus, I disagree with the whole short-term front-loaded idea. I think the stimulus should be mostly infrastructure and mostly about equity as opposed to efficiency, because we've seen in this crisis that depending on your tax bracket has shown how able you are to deal with this crisis. And the people at the lowest end of the bracket, who under Clinton had their benefits cut and under Bush had their benefits cut, are struggling more with this. So I think the stimulus should go to infrastructure, which helps everybody because it makes our country run efficiently. It gets people back to work. It helps our manufacturing, construction industries, also like high tech with the green jobs and whatnot. I believe that this stimulus package should be looking for the future and making, I guess, kind of New Deal-ish, but not necessarily entirely New Deal-ish. I think there should be a lot of like economic incentives, but not necessarily tax cuts, because I think that's a failed model, and the whole supply side economics just kind of failed.
Okay.
How I feel about that. Let's move to the Buy American clause. That's kicking up a lot of dust. A lot of dust. I'm highly curious to see how you feel about this. The Republicans are the ones coming out very strongly against this, and also their international community on Jim Lehrer last night. There was actually an interesting debate between the leader of the AFL-CIO and some representative for the EU, like their trade representative or something. But how do you feel about the Buy American clause? Buy American clause is basically in the stimulus goods that are being used in these products, unless they're 25% more expensive than foreign goods, they're being mandated by American products to build these projects and the stimulus. How do you feel about that?
So
Obama is opposed to it, by the way. Obama is opposed to the Buy American clause. And so are congressional.
Sounded like he wasn't until the EU started whining about it, which just shows him to be a spineless liberal. But anyway, I am actually
because you know, like disregarding the UN has worked out so well for us in every other aspect of governance.
The UN is like
governance.
A paper tiger with no teeth. But let's not get into
who
this.
Made it like that. Well, yeah, that's for next week. We'll talk about that next week. But go ahead.
Useless nations, that's what the UN stands for. But anyway, I am for Buy America Plus, because what's good? What is the good of spending all this money on stimulus if we're not going to spend it on American products? You talk about wanting to create and sustain more American jobs. I'm all for that. And one of the places we need to look is in manufacturing. And if we're not going to use these parts that we're manufacturing, if we're going to use parts made by the lowest bidder in, like, China. Vietnam, or mainly China, yeah. I mean, that does us no good. We may create more jobs building infrastructure and stuff like that. But while we do that, we're also going to be, well, not totally killing, but we're going to be hampering our manufacturing side and people who work in manufacturing, because you may not believe in supply side economics or whatever, but I'm sure you'll agree if supply goes down, or not supply, if demand goes down, then there's less need for people. Say you have a widget factory in Kansas.
Okay.
And we're using these widgets to...
Is it a unionized widget factory?
To make you happy, yes, it's a unionized widget factory. Now, in steps the Shanghai widget factory in China.
Right. Obviously not unionized.
Obviously, state-run. And they are selling 20% less than us, or Kansas Widgets, Inc., whatever. All these people at Kansas Widgets Incorporated are going to be put out of a job. They will not be able to pay their debts. They will lose their houses. They will need unemployment benefits. So if we're stimulating the economy by using widgets, we should be using
American
widgets.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to hop in here because we're pretty much in agreement. I'd like to thank you for stepping up against Senate Republicans who are in strong opposition to this. The arguments for it are, they're all right. I mean, they argue, at least the representative from the EU was, and I guess this is the EU position, they argue that the economic crisis is global in nature, and therefore it deserves global consideration. And us doing this as the largest economic power in the world for now will trigger a domino effect of protectionism across all the other countries in the world. And they're arguing that this places our artificial boundary on our stimulus. And how can we leverage the Chinese, who we argue are always being protectionists, if we're being protectionists? And they also argue the basic economic principle that the less, the lower the number of suppliers, the higher the cost of widgets, and that equals lower efficiency. But I'm inclined to agree with you. Simply because the multiplier of us buying American Business Week here, I'm not usually a big proponent of what Business Week says, but obviously when our government spends money in the country, as you were saying, it's an economic ripple effect. Say, for example, we pay 30% higher for the American widget than the Chinese widget. well, the money that we spend here pays someone a wage, and that wage is pretty likely to get spent in this country, and that wage is also taxed by our government, which means that our government recoups some of that. And if we say pay 30% less for good made in China, we save a little money, but we have no multiplier effect because that money is gone, and it just leaks out. So that's the stimulus. We're pretty much at that time. We're going to switch over to our next topic. Unless there's anything else you want to say.
Something?
We ended a topic with agreement, which may have
you
happened
may have
for
to
the
stop now. I don't.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure this next topic will kick up some dust. We're gonna hop into Gaza real quick, and forgive me.
I think I just saw a rocket whiz by my head.
Right. Excuse me, but I'm gonna read for a little bit. Cause I just came across an article actually entitled America's Secret Role in the Rise of Hamas, which was highly interesting. Keep in mind, it comes from a leftist foreign policy blog, Truth Dig, I believe. I'll put the link up there on my blog as well. But basically, I didn't know this, so for our viewers who may not know us, Hamas is a fairly recent organization, started in the 80s, late 80s. But the model for Hamas is actually quite similar to, say, Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein, in that we are kind of complicit in their rise to power, and they kind of came back to bite us in the ass for doing this. Let's see. Hamas was supported by actually Israel in its early days as a counter movement to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, which was a secular coalition of Fatah, as it stands today, and various other leftist and national movements. And with funding from the U.S.-backed dictatorship in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and U.S., they started funding various schools, healthcare clinics, social organizations, but doing it through Hamas. And Hamas, who is a overtly Islamic group, they realized basically the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So they figure, let's support these Islamists because they'll run these secularists out of business, and everyone would be too busy praying to, and the PLO would just be out of power. So they went on a mission to delegitimize the PLO while funding Hamas. And I'll skip over some of the gory details, but basically, we all know after Oslo and all the conflicts that happened, PLO decided to stop violently resisting. And once they decided to end their armed struggle and rely on a U.S.-led peace process, the Palestinians basically lost all hope in the PLO because they just weren't really doing anything for them. They had given up. It appeared that they had given up on the peace process, and the Palestinian population was not much better off. So Hamas's popularity started to grow after the death of Yasser Arafat, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. And that's how they basically came to power. Once the U.S. decided to force elections in 06, I believe, which all international organizations have said were free and fair. Hamas translated their popularity to electoral victory because of a fractured and corrupt Fatah. And that's when the current crisis happens. Enter Israel, continuing what I would call their causing a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. So the Gaza offensive, Even it's technically ended, but there's still attacks happening across borders on a daily basis. What are your thoughts on the Gaza situation, Paul?
I have a simple question.
Okay.
I think you know the answer.
Right.
Hopefully you know the question. Was or was not Hamas firing rockets from Gaza into Israel?
Yes. Can I ask you a counter question?
Yes.
How many Israelis have died as a result of those rockets?
Look at me. Do I have a paper, pencil, or computer in front of me?
No, but I am willing to guarantee it's less than 20 over the past three, 4 years. And how many Palestinian civilians have died in the past 3-4 years?
Now, you need to be careful how you phrase this, because I see where you're going, and you're wrong, and I'll tell you why you're wrong.
Am I?
Yes, you are. First of all, would you say that if a belligerent country was firing Tomahawk cruise missiles from Canada, so Canada's a belligerent country. If you're Canadian, no offense, I know you're not going to do this. Canada fires cruise missiles into Albany, or Buffalo. Buffalo's close.
Okay.
What would you want America to do, regardless of how many people died?
That's interesting, but there's some presuppositions in there I need to tackle first. I believe you're assuming that the relationship between America and Canada are as similar to than it is today. But the relationship between Israel and Palestine is not that benign. Israel is violating international law by building illegal settlements in the West Bank, and they occupy Gaza. Gaza is not a free state. They are under occupation. They have no right of movement. They don't control their borders. Israel is trying to control the valuable, fertile waterways and lands. And to this day, like on my Facebook right now, I got Google Maps of the illegal Israeli settlements.
That's
in the
nice.
West Bank. So it's...
I've got to be honest. I really don't care, because it's still an attack from Gaza on a sovereign nation.
Because that is why they are attacking. They're not attacking just out of some random irrational hatred for Judaism. They're attacking because for years... Since the creation of Israel, Israel has been building settlements. Well, since 1967, which I guess where the rest of the international community besides us, Israel and our allies, recognized the 1967 UN borders for Israel and Palestine as the official ones. And since then, Israel has been illegally building settlements and conquering Palestine. So the area that these rockets are sent into are areas in which used to be Palestine, but are now illegal under international law settlements. I know that you conservatives don't really put too much stock in international law, but a lot of other countries do. So this is quickly devolving into what usually happens. It becomes Israel versus Hamas. I'm not necessarily a Hamas supporter. I don't support anyone that uses terror, but I would argue that Israel uses terror more effectively and much more destructively in Gaza than $5 rockets that don't kill anyone into illegal settlements. And I'm arguing that the disproportionate death of civilians shows a callousness and a seeming... It's hard for Israel to win this argument because... they are much stronger. They are nuclear power. Gaza, for God's sake, is a huge refugee camp, and people are sending homemade rockets. So I hardly think it's an equal trade-off to say...
Can I stop biting my tongue now?
Sure, go ahead, Paul.
Okay. If Canada were firing rockets into the United States, regardless of any presuppositions or pre-existing conditions, Americans would want us... to go in and either try to stop them diplomatically, that'd be nice. But at some point, probably going to have to go in there and take the rocket launchers out. Now, this high death toll. It's not Israel's fault that Hamas is hiding these rocket launchers in residential neighborhoods. And hospitals
to
schools.
To be fair... Hamas runs those, and they live there. So they have to keep. They're not an army. They don't have an army or air force. They are a government that lives among its people. So of course, their things are kept where people live. That like you know, like if you bomb a Hamas household, since it's so dense there, you're going to be bombing a bunch of other households that have nothing to do with that. So, I mean, I understand that they are not the most savory characters. But I mean, that's a cop out to say we've killed thousands of civilians because of Hamas. The only reason these civilians are dead is because of Hamas. It has nothing to do with us bombing. You know, if you want to terrorism, it's the same thing in Afghanistan. You want to capture one guy, so you bomb an entire country. It just doesn't make any sense. If you want to, you can use police forces. They already occupy Gaza, so why not use methods that incur less civilian damage? It just seems like they're collectively punishing the population of Gaza.
You'll have to forgive me. I need to take a small sidetrack. I was speaking with my father this morning, and you actually just proved his point.
What's that?
This is the difference between a conservative and a liberal. A liberal wants to talk things out, and everything is a police action. We're going to investigate. We're going to arrest people. We're going to try them. Conservatives say, you're bombing us. We're sending some Patriot missiles in to blow your asses up. This is a matter of sovereignty and the defense of one's nation. Hamas, I don't care if they're launching 5-cent rockets.
Okay.
They're attacking
hold on,
Israel
hold on.
And its people.
Okay, so you just brought up a good point. Sovereignty of one's nation. Palestine, the whole of Palestine, all the population of Palestine, has been being punished for electing a group. Since that they elected a group who has at times been willing to ceasefire. They democratically elected them in free and fair elections, and we started sanctioning them and collectively punishing their whole government. And Israel is invading. If you live in Gaza, you cannot go out of Gaza. And if you do, they will not let you back in because Israeli soldiers are at the checkpoints, and the border with Egypt is sealed. So if you want to talk about sovereignty, the Gazans are the ones that have the stronger argument for sovereignty because where Hamas is firing rockets under international law isn't Israel, it's Palestine. So technically they're firing rockets inside their own internationally accepted borders.
Here's an easy question. How long have there been tribal organizations with territory on the planet Earth?
For a long time.
Thank you. How long have there been territorial wars of territorial expansion? The answer is probably as long as we've been
okay,
here.
Okay, but Israel
this
is an artificial state, though.
Territorial expansion.
Israel's an artificial state. It was created artificially in what, the 60s?
47.
47? I'm sorry. Sorry. Yeah, that I definitely undercut it. It was in the 40s. But so that argument, I think, is kind of null and void because it's an artificial state that – and for the fact, like, the Gazans were there. That's their – like – is it not strange that no other country in the world besides us and the people that are
were
beholden to us?
Were the Aborigines in Australia when the British showed up? Were the Native
yeah,
Americans
and it's
a, in America
and it's wrong
when
what and
we
it's wrong what
up.
The Australians are doing to the Aborigines. It's still wrong, despite the fact that it happened. But let me read a quote from Bill Moyers on the show last week. Brute force can turn self-defense into state terrorism. It's what the U.S. did in Vietnam with B-52s and napalm, and again in Iraq with shock and awe. By killing indiscriminately the elderly, kids, entire families, by destroying schools and hospitals, Israel did exactly what terrorists do and exactly what Hamas wanted. It spilled the blood that turns the wheel of retribution. Do you think that bombing Gaza and invading
Gaza... You just proved my point. They did exactly what Hamas wanted. Hamas put their own people in the targets. You cannot blame Israel for attacking launch sites where Hamas deliberately put them there.
No, okay.
They have
okay.
said they tried to avoid killing See, children and civilians. You can't help it. It's war, for God's sake.
Okay, I'm not absolving Hamas of responsibility because since they don't have an army, they do live among their population, and that's irresponsible. It puts people at risk. But the you can't just say, "Oh, Israel tried." Sorry, there are ways to do war to incur less civilian damage. And blanketly bombing the most densely populated place on Earth is not one of those ways. I'm arguing that the most advanced and expensive military in the region can figure out more efficient ways of killing who they need to kill without bombing and Gaza. And bombing Gaza, that's too small of a frame, because Israel does not only bomb Gaza, they collectively punish the population of Gaza, which is a crime under international law, the UN, Geneva Conventions, all that, by closing borders, not letting in aid. That is collective punishment.
So what you're telling me is Egypt is also violating international law by closing their borders.
Yes, yes. Egypt needs to step up, and Egypt only steps up in when things get really bad, because they are also beholden to certain interests. And the problem is, no one wants to legitimize Hamas, but by not giving... Okay, I'm trying to think of a good way to explain this. No one wants to legitimize Hamas, so they want to bomb them. But by bombing Hamas, you're bombing the Palestinian people who democratically elected Hamas. So even if you bomb everyone in Hamas, the people there are still going to be angry. And the people that brought Hamas to power still don't have anyone to recognize them. So would it not be more efficient to defang Hamas by actually giving them some say and saying, now you have no reason to send rockets? Because Hamas sends rockets because they say, no one will listen to us, no one will bargain with us, no one will listen to our grievances, so this is all we can do is send rockets. But if you say, okay, we will stop building illegal settlements, we will open your borders, but now you have no excuses to send rockets, then it delegitimizes Hamas in the eyes of their own people, because they see, hey, so them sending rockets isn't helping, and Israel is willing to talk to us. Maybe Israel isn't that bad, and we can get somewhere. Well, what I'm simply arguing is that this tactic, whether or not you believe Hamas is in the right or wrong, the way that Israel and the United States have gone about this, we cause this problem by empowering them to further our means, much like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And it comes back to bite us in the ass, because we fund these unsavory groups, but then when they want to address the concerns of their populations, we don't want to hear it.
Let me try to answer all your questions.
Yeah, I talked for a while. I apologize. Go ahead, Paul.
I am not saying that Israel is completely in the right, because they're not. What I am saying... What am I saying? My whole train of thought just got derailed. I think if both sides want peace in the middle, in Israel and Gaza, which I hope they do, I think they do, then both sides are going to have to make concessions.
And exactly, that's the sense of frustration.
Let me answer the question.
Israel doesn't seem to want to make concessions, but go ahead.
In terms, I was speaking in terms of the specific conflict before. In terms of the general conflict, I think both sides are to blame. No, Israel should not be building these settlements. I'm not a fan of international law, but if it's recognized Palestinian territory, then you shouldn't be building settlements there without opposition. So I think both sides need to make concessions.
Right. Right. And that's basically what it comes down to, is the settlements, because there was just elections held in Israel, I believe, recently, and I believe the right-wing are poised to gain ground. And the settlements are still continuing in the West Bank. So, I mean, from my point of view, I may come off as anti-Israel, but that's because they are the stronger nation, and they're the ones... They are in a position where they can sacrifice. Hamas and Palestinians feel like they've been sacrificing ever since Israel was created. So they're tired of sacrificing, which is why they're sending rockets. If Israel would stop illegally building settlements or putting up a settlement wall, which you can also call an apartheid wall, then maybe Hamas, and would either be defanged, and their people would abandon them, or they would have to become more moderate. Because at times, especially in towards Hamas's founding, they have been moderate in terms of a relationship with Israel.
Oh, my turn! Yay. First of all, I don't want it to sound like I'm anti-Palestine. I'm actually I think you can be both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine, in as much as you want both of them to coexist without the Israelis bombing hospitals and schools.
Yes.
And without Hamas sending rockets.
UN hospitals and schools, even.
Oh, if it's the UN, that no, never mind.
So, and it's interesting because they did coexist before Israel was created. Before the state of Israel was created, they all lived in that territory in one area. But since that happened, I believe about 60% of
one, sorry, one thing you do have to remember is, especially in modern history, before things were turned over to Israel, it was not actually a Palestinian state per se. It was actually a British protectorate.
That is true. That is true. So the history of imperialism rears its ugly head. So we can at least agree that both sides are complicit in this, and both sides need to make concessions in order for any type of peace deal to be made.
Well, yes, certainly, because if there aren't concessions by Israel, then the Palestinians...
Right. Right. Indeed. Indeed. Let's see. Fill some time for the Haaretz. I definitely did not pronounce that right. But a Israeli newspaper recently just broke news about the extent of the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Which this is another thing. People would like to empower Fatah. We didn't talk too much about Fatah, but this is why people are supporting Hamas in Palestine, because Fatah has control of the West Bank, and yet they are continuing to let these illegal settlements be built. They are completely impotent in the face of Israel. But there's been 100 recent unauthorized settler outposts since the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, 75% of the construction in these settlements was carried out illegally, and more than 30 settlements buildings have been built on private Palestinian land. In effect, they just kicked Palestinians off the land, built something there, and built a wall up, and then the Israeli government is denying this, of course. But I think we've pretty much exhausted this topic. We got a good 10 minutes left. Is there anything else in the news you'd like to talk about, Paul? Let's see. We got stimulus. Sure. Let's talk about soccer. How you're a Liverpool fan, right?
Yes, sir. I am.
How does it feel that Manchester United took your throne, and you guys can't seem to get it back?
Well, first of all, the gap is only 2 points
on the table.
For now.
Yes, Man United does have a game in hand, but I'm pretty sure all of Liverpool's games against title contenders are at Anfield as opposed to Old Trafford.
Yeah.
And they just beat Chelsea 2-0 at the weekend. So they had a hiccup in midseason, but I think you're seeing them return to form towards the home stretch. Besides that loss last night to Everton in the FA Cup.
Well, that okay, I'll forgive that because it's the FA Cup, but a loss to Everton, that's rough. I hope you guys had your second team in. But how about Man City spending all types of money?
Well, that's the thing. They're trying to spend all types of money.
Well, yeah, trying.
But people aren't going.
Yeah.
You had the reported, I think it was 216 million U.S. to get Kaká from AC Milan.
That was not going to happen. I just couldn't see that happening. Kaká going to a nobody team from AC Milan.
Well, you have to remember, Man City was not always the nobody team.
Yeah, of course.
Just like Man United was not always the
great team.
All-conquering team.
Right. As we currently are, better than everyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Double champions. But you know who I'm actually, and it shames me to say it, but I'm actually starting to become kind of scared of? Arsenal. They are... Are Chavin from Russia going to Arsenal? That's kind of crazy, man.
That was the transfer saga of the year. Very starting true. In the summer after the Euros, which is quite frankly when they should have sold him. Because that's
right.
When he was at his peak value.
Yeah,
they should have taken,
at his peak.
I think it was the 20 million pounds that they were asking.
That's when Russian football was at its peak in general.
I mean, now you look at his numbers this season. Zenit are, I think they're out of the UEFA Cup, let alone the Champions League.
Right.
And if you look at Arshavin's numbers, they have not been what they were last season. But I don't think he would fudge it to bring his value down, but we'll see how he does at the Emirates.
True. I actually think that he might be a pretty good fit. I mean, they have a nice young team there, and... A lot of the players I just don't dislike. You know, I just dislike some types of players. But, I mean, I can't really hate on them as much as I would like to. I know Rossam's going to delight in this. He's an Arsenal fan. But I think they're going to be a force to reckon with next season.
Well, the thing is, they have a good young squad.
Yeah.
Without real leadership, they have... Cesc Fabregas, but
yeah.
I mean, if you look at that's really all they have.
Yeah.
Since
and
they
he's,
sold
he's hurt
Thierry
right now,
Henry,
right? Yeah,
he could play anywhere on the field. He'd bring other players. He improved all the players around him. I think they've been missing that real leader since he's gone.
Right.
And it's just we're left to see if Arshavin can fill that role.
Right, and just the fact of a goal scorer, I think they've been lacking a consistent goal scorer. I mean, Cesc scored some goals. Ben Ayoun had a little run for a while, but I think he's back to being.
Ben Ayoun plays for
Liverpool. Yeah, you're right. Arsenal. Who? Theo Walcott. That's who it was. He had a little run, but
he had a very short. I think.
Yeah, it was short.
A real victim of all of his hype going into the World Cup because he did nothing at the World Cup.
Right.
In fact, he was outclassed. He
exactly. Yeah, I wouldn't expect
see
him to
do
much.
Making the squad if England had made it to the Euros this year, and you have Robin van Persie.
Well, I mean, I think he would because I mean, it's England. Their team is kind of in disrepair after the World Cup.
I mean, right now they have Robin van Persie, but he's been injured a lot. He's probably. Was probably their best striker. They have Nicholas Bentner, but he could be at a higher level someday. But right now, he's not there.
Wow, I did not know that Manchester City has Sean Wright Phillips now.
Well, remember he's actually started at Man City, then
went to Chelsea.
I forget what outrageous fee that Chelsea paid for him.
That wasn't a loan. That was a transfer.
That was a transfer.
Right.
But he never really fit in there, so they actually sold him back, I think at a loss. Of course, the other big transfer deadline
Don't
day deal
it.
Was Robbie Keane from Liverpool back to Tottenham Hotspur after Liverpool had paid, I want to say, around 20 million. And this is all in pounds because I don't have my handy-dandy converter in front of me. But, I mean, he in 19 appearances, he had... 4 goals. He was never really fitting in, losing time to Torres, who is
a monster,
absolutely fantastic.
He's probably the only player from Liverpool that I would take. Fernando. I mean, I think he's your whole team, honestly, because if he's out, who do you have to really step in? you know, cute?
Well, you see, I think it's you've really seen it since Torres came over. Dirk Cout is really, he's made a transition. He's not so much the front player anymore. He does a lot of wing play.
Right.
He's very good at making plays down the wings. I don't think he's just that out-and-out goal scorer in front.
I think there's a missing piece, because I don't think Q and Torres work well together, because both of them like to drift out wide.
I mean, the best partnership right now is Gerrard and Torres. I forget. I was watching a game a couple weeks ago. I forget who it was against, but you just see nothing. You see Torres with his back to goal, and in one fluid motion, he takes the ball down off his chest. Just a back heel right into space.
Beautiful. I love Torres because he can start out by the corner flag and 10 seconds later be celebrating a goal. I have no idea how he does it. It's amazing. I see here Quaresma moved to Chelsea. I think that's a big pickup. Quaresma is highly skilled. He's very dangerous. He didn't do too much at Inter. I myself don't watch Italian football too much. But he didn't do too much at Inter, and I think he'll do a lot at Chelsea. If the coach lets him play, just send him out on
remember,
the wing.
It's Big Phil, and Big Phil did coach Quaresma on the Portuguese national team.
Right.
But I think the problem you may be seeing with Chelsea this year is a similar problem to what you saw with Real Madrid in their down years, is they keep buying these big stars. You definitely need stars on a team, but you also need pieces that they don't have to have the ball all the time, but you need position players.
I think Chelsea suffers specifically in the back. They can stop people from scoring, but they don't get clean sheets. And I think they need some help in the back.
I mean, it's not down to Peter Cech. He's
a monster.
Top two or three
in the
goalkeepers
world.
In the world.
Easily.
Yeah.
Easily.
I mean, but if you look at their back line, they have...
besides Terry.
John Terry.
Who is amazing.
Who is rightfully the England captain.
Yes,
he should have had
course.
It long before Sven was sacked.
Right.
But if you look at it, you've got Terry... You've got João Bisinga. I think his name's João.
Yeah, Bisinga.
Who is not a bad player, but
he needs time. Yeah, he needs time to come into his form. He's not going to be, if he ever gets to that top tier, it's going to be a few years. And probably some international
where
play.
Particularly vulnerable at this point is
right.
Actually down the wings. Because you have Ricardo Carvalho and Terry, who are both good center backs. But, I mean, they've just sold Wayne Bridge, who was actually probably better than some of the people they were playing,
right.
But they've just really had a revolving door in the wingback positions. You look at Glenn Johnson, Paulo Ferreira, he's now at Valencia, and you just look at these people who keep leaving the club.
Right. Interesting. See here, Alexander Kleb went to Barcelona. I wonder how he'll fit in there. So let's see if he gets any playing time over there.
Because Thierry Henry barely gets any playing time over there.
I try to hate them because their team isn't fair, but it's just great. I don't understand how they're not, like, how they weren't. I knew that Man U would beat them in UEFA, but I, or Champions League, but they're an amazing squad, and I think they're going to be, they're going to be a force to be reckoned with in European play. Who's your international squad?
Germany, of course.
Germany,
German boy.
How do you guys think you're going to do? Because I noticed Podolski has gone down in form a lot. They traded him off to some, what team they trade him to? Some nobody team. Well, not a nobody team, but definitely of a lower stature than Bayern Munich. Klose's getting kind of old.
Well,
Schweinsteiger, I don't think really was performing.
Particularly alarming. I find the fact that our two best strikers are not actually German. They're, in fact, Polish.
Right, right. Just don't talk about that. pretend
they're
German.
What Germany needs now is almost like a Beckenbauer-like figure. Because right now there's no real leader.
Right.
Before the Euros, I might have said it could be Schweinsteiger. But
I love Schweinsteiger, honestly.
He's
a
great
player.
But
great
the
player.
Way he acts in the field sometimes,
yeah,
it's not a leader.
Yeah.
He is a hothead.
He's like Wayne Rooney. You never know what's going to happen. But I don't know. I go back and forth between Portugal and Spain. After watching Euro, Spain's team is amazing, the way they play. Whoever their coach is, though, is a moron. Because I've watched too many games of him putting Fernando Torres on the bench. If I'm a coach, Fernando Torres is not going on the bench until the 88th minute, 89th minute, to a standing ovation.
You look at Spain, the problem is they have so much attacking quality. It's almost absurd.
In terms of, I agree with you in terms of like their midfield, but in their strikers, I think they need Torres up there because I noticed when
you have Raul, you have David Villa.
David Villa definitely was a great move for them. But I believe their formation, they play very midfield heavy. Like David Villa, I think he, you could call him a attacking mid, I suppose, or a striker at times, the way they put him in the formation. But I don't know. We'll see. We're running out of time. We're going a little bit over. So I just want to get your opinion on the player I don't like talking about, but we're going to have to. Beckham going to Italy. How do you feel?
I've got to be honest. I really did. I saw it coming the whole way. Because when he came over here, you had an England squad managed by Steve McClaren who had no use for him.
Right.
So he thought his international career was basically over. And America is a very attractive place to come to retire as a footballer because they're looking for old stars, and the taxes here are pretty good.
And the fact that they that rule that lets them get one player out of their salary cap, and it's Los Angeles, and they could give him a buttload of money to bring him over here.
I mean, if you look at it, though, I mean, look at what he's done with the Galaxy. He really hasn't done anything for them. He's spent a lot of time injured. I think he wants to go back now because I think he sees there's a chance for him to get back in the international fold. He's never going to be England captain again.
Oh, no, never, 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 never.
Because if you look at their options down the right, you have him, you have Aaron Lennon. Aaron Lennon's going to be a very good player. He's still a bit young, though. I think he could actually do well with having David Beckham back in the squad and just learning from him.
Right. I think the England squad is suffering right now. I think it's going to be a couple years till they're back to a really dangerous side. Because even on the top of my head, I can't really think of too many dangerous powers that England has. But I just think Beckham is past his time. I think he can do one thing, and he can do one thing well, and that's bend it on the free kicks. And if you want to spend the money it'll cost to have him kick a couple free kicks for you, then I say go ahead.
It's not just the free kicks, though. It's the way he waits every pass, every cross-field ball. Yeah, he can't run at defenders anymore. He can't really do that.
He can't play high intensity. He's not durable.
But he can make, when he's on the field, he makes everyone around him better.
I'll agree with you tentatively. I think he is an okay facilitator, and his intelligence masks a lot of his physical shortcomings.
I mean, if you watch the NFL, they always talk about the football IQ.
Right, right.
You look at players like him, Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard, David Silva with Spain.
Okay, but my thing, I don't think he's in the conversation with them. I think he's a tier lower.
On ability now, you're right, he is. But in terms of knowing what to do, knowing what needs to go where, knowing exactly what has to be done, I think he's on par with them.
Like me, I will take I'll take Lampard or Ballack over Beckham any day. I'll even take Owen Hargreaves over Owen Hargreaves is a great midfielder, but yeah, we're going over. Thank you guys for listening to Circular Progress for another week. Next week we'll argue about some more shit. So tune in. I'm Alex.
I'm Paul.
And stay cool.
Later.